Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Material Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the web edition of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Sean Marr. He's an assistant professor in the Biology Department at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Sean, you and I have met, but I don't know exactly what you do. I have some idea. Can you talk a little bit about your broad research interests?
I'm really interested in how the environment influences species occurrence across space. I'm particularly interested in how small mammals react to environmental change and habitat. In addition to that, how their ectoparasites are correlated with where we find small mammals and some of the environmental constraints on the ectoparasites.
Now, you have field work and computational. Let's talk about the field work first. So how's the field work exactly done?
We use Sherman live traps, which are these kind of standard traps, bait them with things like sunflower seeds and peanut butter. Animals walk in, door shuts behind them. Then we can get them out of the trap, identify them to species, things like white-footed mice, wood rats, hispid cotton rats. Those are pretty common around here in the Ozarks. Mark them, release them, and might do things like population estimates. We'll also brush them for ectoparasites, pull off things like ticks, mites, identify whether they've got botflies, those sorts of things.
Now, are you interested in only species that are indigenous to the Ozarks, or are you looking at other kinds of animals too?
In my research, I've got a couple different prongs of places where I work. So I've got data. A lot of the field stuff that's happened over the last 4 or 5 years has been here in the Ozarks. I collaborate with a number of people, so I actually got to work on a couple projects on some mammals in Southeast Asia. Right. I've done some stuff with California mammals, Great Basin mammals.
But would these have been historical mammals in the Ozarks, or could they be invasive? Just like you can find pythons in Florida, but I don't think they're usually there.
So in the Ozarks, we don't have too many invasive small mammals. We got things like house mice and black rats and that sort of stuff. Out in when we do field trapping, we don't really catch a whole lot of those things.
So mostly it's stuff that's been here for a while.
Probably, yeah. And then we've got some things with armadillos. So armadillos have expanded their range. So I wouldn't call them invasive necessarily, or maybe I wouldn't consider them invasive because they're not necessarily problematic. But their expansion is not necessarily like an introduction by us.
Now, when you go out there, exactly what happens? So how many... I'm kind of fascinated by field work, being a person who's been stuck in a lab my entire career. Do you make strong notes about where you are and look at the local area and take pictures of it and things like that? Or do you just say, here's where we are, GPS coordinates, and that's enough? Or do you take like...
So there's a couple ways. You could do the GPS thing, and some people do that. I try to follow the Grinnellian notes method, which is a standard way to actually collect field notes and write about what you've seen. And that means you document everything that you've experienced while you're in the field. So you make lots of observations, even if the observations aren't about your task at hand. So mentioning that you see blue jays or something in this habitat so that you've got a whole natural, almost whole natural history record of your field experience.
Would you mention things like the weather?
Oh, yeah.
The wetness of the ground and things like that?
Weather, temperature, humidity, moon phase can be important. Cloudiness can be important for small mammals because of cover and that sort of thing too.
And are you catching them at night and then studying them in the day? Are they nocturnal primarily?
Most of them are going to, we set the traps in the evening and you check them in the morning. There's a few diurnal things, like we could set them if you're really interested in chipmunks. You'd set them at different times or leave them open. So you'd set the traps open. We open them in the evening, check them in the morning, let them go as soon as we handle.
Now, are you guys camping out there? I'm just curious. Are you camping? Is it a field trip in that sense, camping during the summer primarily or during the school year?
I've had students that have gone out and done camping. So a recent graduate student camped and did a bunch of surveys here in the Ozarks. I've had several students actually work down at the Bull Shoals Field Station, and so they've been able to stay there. Mm-hmm. And then I take students, undergrads in the mammalogy class, out and down to the field station.
Now, this probably, I'm guessing, resonates very strongly with students. Is that true? I mean, a lot of students around here seem to really like connections to, let's call it, not exactly wildlife biology, but they feel a strong connection. Do you think this resonates with your students?
I think so. One of the most popular things for the undergraduates here at Missouri State is to when they take the mammology classes, they really like the field trip component. So we do an overnight field trip down at the field station. Mm-hmm. So we go two nights, we set out traps, and sometimes we catch, we have like 50% trap success. That happened 3 years ago. And last year we had like 1% trap success.
Now, when you think about your own motivation, and I'm fascinated by this, because if somebody asks you how to get into a field, sometimes you look back on it and you say, well, I'm not sure exactly myself. And so would you say you were always interested in this sort of thing, or did you fall into it, or how did it happen?
I think I fell into the mammal aspect. I was very interested in the spatial aspect of where we find critters as an undergraduate. And then when I got into my master's program, it was supposed to be kind of a professional thing, and I took mammology. And the professor, Phil Myers, presented something about how he was working with these small mammals and the influence of climate change on which small mammal is there. And I talked to him afterwards, and that's basically what I've been doing since.
Now, you talk about spatial distributions, essentially. And so in a lot of cases, biology majors we find in the physics department, let's not say they sometimes seem to have a fear of mathematics at some level. But the things you're doing, how much math would you want your students to have? Probably maybe more than they might expect. Is that right?
I don't have a high expectation for a lot of math knowledge, right? So in our program, they've got to have pre-calc and that sort of stuff.
Sure.
And they can basically execute a lot of the surveys and do some of the modeling with that level of experience. Now, if they wanted to go on and do this professionally, they're going to have to pick up a little bit more math, or at least a good comprehension of that.
Right.
I never took calculus in college.
You've self-taught.
Well, I took calculus in high school, and that was the last time I took a math class.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, it was the—
Yeah, no, I know. That's one of the things we see.
Yeah.
How did you take your physics class? The calc class you had in high school got you through the physics you had to take in college.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah. So now let's get to the computational work. You and I met in a computational seminar, and we're both interested in some work like that, and you actually do it as part of your professional work. So talk about what the computational aspect, the modeling aspect of this looks like.
A lot of it is using machine learning methods that you find in computer science and then applying them to these ecological, biological questions. So I've worked a lot with this modeling algorithm that uses a machine learning approach to find or fit coefficients in a linear model. And that was actually devised in a non-biological sense. But now everybody who does these things called niche models or distribution models uses this MaxNet or MaxEnt package.
Right.
So
if you did something like that, how does this start? You say to yourself, well, I've studied so many of these, I know that when I go to do a new study, I know exactly how I'm going to approach this. Or will the specifics of the actual field work and the thing you're studying dictate what kinds of modeling approaches you will take?
I think it's based on the question at hand, and that determines which model.
Can you give me an example?
So in let's say we were looking at how species respond to climate change, more recent climate change over the last 100 years, right? In that sense, what we could do is if we've got museum records, we could build models of where they were historically and where they are now in the modern era, and then fit things like these hierarchical occupancy models that basically allow for uncertainty in detection and presence simultaneously. And then we can get a nice small picture or a picture of the regional pattern of change. At very large scales, you can't really do some of those hierarchical occupancy models if you're looking at nationwide things, because you don't have the detail you need to fit the model. And
right.
So you've got to change it to, say, one of these MaxEnt models, something like a boosted regression tree to kind of correlate environment to occurrence.
So I'm curious when you have that. So you bring a student in, it's a grad student maybe, or maybe it's an undergraduate, and it doesn't sound like there's any selling that needs to be done on the field work. They're going to just, I think they're going to, at least it seems to me, they're going to eat that up. Do you have to like bring them slowly into the fold on the modeling end so as not to scare them off, or do they jump in wholeheartedly to that?
It's been a little bit of both. I think I've got a couple. I've had a couple of graduate students that jumped in on the models. I think everybody's. I agree. I think everybody jumps in on the field work. They really like that aspect. A lot of the undergraduates that I've had pass through the lab, where we fit some of these computational type models, because we don't have time to go out and do a field season for them in that amount, or in their window of availability. They get excited after the fact when they realize what we're able to do with these different data sets.
Right. Now, your students, so in physics, if somebody gets a bachelor's degree, there's still a lot of opportunity, primarily in the defense industry or semiconductor industry or something like that. So when your students leave the lab, at either the bachelor or master's level, are they more likely to go on to some doctoral program or some other graduate work, or where might they be going? What would they look for?
Well, so far, three of my four finished graduate students have gone on to PhD programs. The fourth, she works in an environmental consulting company doing field work and data analysis things. I've got a fifth student that does a bunch of field work and data analysis in consulting. But I think a lot of students end up with a set of skills that allows them to go to different places.
Sure.
I had an undergraduate when I was a postdoc at Berkeley who ends up, she works for Google now as a GIS person.
Sure.
Even though her bachelor's degree was emphasis in biology.
Yeah, so. Let's talk about your computational stuff a little bit more. So you say GIS, that's what, geographical information systems or something like that. But you use statistical packages and other kinds of stuff programmed primarily in a language R, is that right?
Correct.
That's open source, is that not?
Correct, yeah.
So the students have to learn how to use that. And would you say that they have enough experience in programming? We're finding still that students, amazingly enough, have very limited programming experience when they get to an undergraduate program, even in physics. What are you guys finding over there?
Oh, yeah. I don't think many of them have that much experience. When I teach a couple of my classes, I emphasize using R and that programming, scripting language in it. So, for instance, like population ecology, we do a bunch of R stuff. So, we talk about a model of how species interact, and then we fit those models and we look at how terms in those models influence outcome using R. And so, students walk in with basically zero R experience and walk out knowing how to deal with ordinary differential equations in R, how to fit species distribution models and those sorts of things.
Okay, so. Good. Now, your funding, you go places for funding. We all know in the sciences, there's a lot of different places to go to, and it can be all over the map, from the National Science Foundation to the National Institute of Health, to the Department of Energy, Department of Defense. There's a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And I would suspect that the places that you go for funding would, in some way, shape, or form, they could have conflicting or, let's just say, slightly different views about the efficacy of the stuff that you do. And so when you go for funding, talk about the places you get funding, to whom you're going, and what their interest is in what you do.
For the most part, the funding I've looked into have been sometimes they're applied questions. They need something like question X answered, and they've got some data or they want somebody to try to answer that data or figure out how to answer it. And that I've done that, some Park Service stuff, for instance. NSF, I'm going to try to get something in there this summer, but it's going to be a big basic question about species here in the Ozarks and what's mediating their population fluctuations and their occurrence across southwest Missouri, especially from a community standpoint, and tie that into ectoparasites, things like ticks. I've also been on proposals where the questions were about climate change, how recent climate change is influencing species across various landscapes. So there's a Fish and Wildlife Service collaborative project called the LCCs, the Landscape Cooperative something, but they offer proposals, and most of those are emphasized on climate change.
Okay. Let me think here for a second. Well, amazingly enough, I think we've covered most of what's going on. So, Sean, thanks so much for stopping by.
No worries. Thanks for the invitation.
And thanks for listening. This is Dave Cornelson for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.